Acatra Foundation presents the Acatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Acatra AI. Hey there, and welcome. Today we're diving into the life and mind of someone truly unique, a polymath, really, a comedian whose genius seemed completely effortless, almost accidental.
But it was anything but. Right.
Exactly. We're talking about Steve Martin, and specifically, we're looking at his journey through his fantastic memoir, Born Standing Up.
It's a fascinating read, and it's significant because Martin wasn't just funny. He completely reinvented stand-up comedy for a generation. His story really pulls back the curtain on what it takes to create something truly original.
Yeah, it demystifies the whole creative genius myth. It shows the sheer hard work, the intellectual effort, and honestly, the bravery involved.
And the bravery to know when to stop, too, which is maybe the most surprising part.
Definitely. Yeah. Okay, let's get into his chronological journey. It doesn't start on a massive stage, but actually as a pretty shy kid in Southern California.
Right, and his first real stage wasn't a comedy club at all. It was Disneyland.
At 10 years old, working in the magic shop.
Yeah, and this wasn't just, you know, selling tricks. He became obsessed. Illusions, gags, timing, how to hold an audience's attention. It was basically his performance school.
He really learned the fundamentals there. Misdirection, confidence.
And he had a mentor figure, Wally Bogue, a vaudeville performer at Disneyland. Old school entertainer.
Ah, so he learned those classic comedy rhythms early on.
Exactly. Thousands of hours just watching, practicing, absorbing. It hammers home that idea from the book. Mastery isn't magic, it's mileage. He was like an apprentice learning a very precise craft.
And then from Disneyland, he went to Knott's Berry Farm, another theme park.
Yep, the Birdcage Theater, performing multiple times a day, honing his banjo playing, working out routines, still mastering the traditional stuff before he even thought about breaking the mold.
It's interesting, though, he wasn't just doing performance. He was in college, too, right? Studying something quite different.
Philosophy and logic. And that's key. It totally reshaped how he thought about comedy. He started analyzing jokes, not just as, you know, funny things, but as logical structures.
Like equations.
Sort of, yeah. He'd break them down, question why they worked. It's that classic learn the rules before you break them idea. But he took it really seriously, intellectually.
So that foundation was incredibly diverse. Magic, vaudeville, music, philosophy.
All feeding into what would come later, but later it took a while. The next phase was pretty tough.
Yeah, the wilderness years. Whole decade, right? Trying to make it stand-up clubs.
Brutal environment. He talks about playing to tiny audiences, sometimes hostile ones, opening for rock bands who just wanted him off the stage. Lots of loneliness, tons of self-doubt.
So how did he keep going? What fueled him through that?
Well, this is where the really interesting shift happens. He started consciously developing what people now call his anti-comedy style.
Anti-comedy? What does that mean exactly?
He theorized, quite deliberately, that if he took away the punchline, the audience's expectation of a joke would build this tension.
And the tension itself becomes funny.
Precisely. Or at least that was the goal. He'd use absurd props, the arrow through the head, balloon animals, but present them with this deadpan seriousness, like a magician revealing a grand illusion.
So the joke wasn't the prop, it was the performance of seriousness around something ridiculous.
You got it. And the audience's confusion was part of the act. He actually said he wanted to make the audience the butt of the joke.
Wow, that takes some guts. Especially back then.
Oh, absolutely. He stuck with it for years, playing to almost nobody sometimes. But he treated every gig like data collection, every awkward silence, every small laugh. He was learning, refining.
He talks about a vicious circle, but a good one.
Yeah. The consistent work enhanced my sense of identity, and the identity boosted my work. It was this feedback loop built on sheer persistence and, as he charmingly put it, naivete. That belief that you can do something even when you don't know how impossible it seems.
So the struggle itself forged the unique style. And then things started to shift.
Slowly, yeah. The culture started catching up, maybe. That post-Vietnam era, people were maybe more open to irony, to things being deconstructed.
And then came television. That had to be huge.
Massive catalyst. First, getting spots on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson gave him national exposure. But the real game changer was hosting Saturday Night Live.
Right, SNL. Young audience, hip. Ready for something different.
Exactly. They got the irony. They embraced the characters. The catchphrases like, well, excuse me, it just exploded.
But crucially, TV didn't create the act.
No, it showcased what he'd already spent a decade perfecting in obscurity. Perfect timing, perfect platform for a fully formed radical act.
And this leads to the peak, right? The late 70s.
Unbelievable peak. Biggest comedian in the world, arguably. Platinum albums, comedy albums selling like rock records, sold out arenas, 20,000 people a night, the white suit, iconic.
Just unheard of for a comedian back then.
Totally. But, and this is a big but in the book, that massive success had an artistic cost.
How so?
Well, the act that was born in small clubs, full of subtlety and nuance, it had to get broader to play in an arena, more reliant on the catchphrases, the big physical bits.
So the intimacy was lost.
Completely. And the joy of invention started to fade for him. It became repetition, playing the hits night after night. The success, paradoxically, started to kill the creative spark that led to it.
And there was that undercurrent, too, with his father.
Yeah, a very complex relationship. His dad was emotionally distant, never really seemed to approve, even when Steve was hugely successful, dismissing a Time magazine review.
Ouch. Now, that must have driven him, but also left a void, maybe.
It seems like it. That yearning for validation is palpable in the book. It adds this really human layer to the obsessive drive.
Which makes the next step even more astounding. He reaches this absolute pinnacle.
And then in 1981, he just stops. Quits stand-up completely.
Just walks away from sellout crowds and number one albums. Why?
Not burnout. Not scandal. It was a conscious artistic choice. He felt the act was done. Complete. Like a painting finished.
He said it had a beginning, middle, and end.
Exactly. To keep doing it felt dishonest to him, like a forgery. And he felt disconnected from the giant crowds, from the character he was playing. The relationship was gone.
So he pivots to movies, starting with The Jerk.
Which became another huge success, obviously. But that decision to quit stand-up is maybe the core of his artistic integrity, knowing when the work is finished.
Okay, so looking back at this whole arc, what's the core philosophy here? What really drove Steve Martin?
I think fundamentally it's about deliberate practice and the long game. He wasn't waiting for inspiration. He was grinding it out, meticulously building his craft over, what, 18 years for the stand-up part?
10 years learning, 4 refining, 4 in success. That breakdown is amazing.
It really reframes success as just the tip of the iceberg, right?
Yeah.
Underneath is all that work. And related to that is his belief in innovation through deconstruction.
You keep things apart to understand them, then rebuilding them differently.
Yeah, not just making funnier jokes, but asking, what is a joke? And playing with that structure, challenging the assumptions of the audience and the form itself.
There's also a clear sense of the artist's isolation, even when famous.
Definitely. Playing to thousands, but feeling disconnected. But coupled with that is the courage to evolve, to know when something is finished, even if it's successful, and to move on. That takes real guts.
He mentions a fear of being boring, too.
Yeah, comedy was my way of not being boring. That fear seems like a powerful motivator, pushing him to constantly innovate and eventually to pivot entirely away from stand-up.
And the tension between art and commerce is always there.
Constantly. How do you maintain integrity when the market wants you to just repeat the hits? He wrestled with that and ultimately chose integrity over repetition.
Okay, let's try to pinpoint 3 specific moments that really changed everything for him. Pivotal turning points.
Yeah. Well, the first one has to be that Disneyland magic shop experience. It wasn't just a job. It was where he fundamentally learned performance craft, timing, audience control. Without that foundation, nothing else follows.
Right, the apprenticeship years. What's the second?
I'd say the conscious decision during those tough club years to develop and stick with anti-comedy. That was the moment he stopped trying to be like other comics and started defining his own unique, risky path. It was an intellectual and artistic gamble that defined his entire stand-up career.
Embracing the weirdness, basically. Huh. Okay. And the third.
It has to be quitting stand-up in 1981, at the absolute height of his fame. That decision crystallizes his artistic philosophy that the work itself has integrity, it has a lifespan, and true growth means knowing when to let go and start something new, even if it means walking away from unimaginable success.
Yeah, that's incredibly powerful. So when we reflect on his journey, what are the human lessons here? What can we, you know, take away for our own lives?
Well, there's definitely the theme of persistence through difficulty. Those wilderness years weren't easy. Sticking with a vision when no one gets it, that resonates.
Absolutely. And the idea of failure just being data, not taking it personally, but using it to learn and adjust, that's applicable anywhere.
For sure. Also, the potential cost of huge success, that paradox that achieving the goal can sometimes kill the thing you loved about the process. It makes you think about what success really means to you.
Right. Is it the external validation, the arenas, Or is it the internal satisfaction of creating, of growing?
And his struggle for his father's approval. That's deeply human, that drive for validation, and maybe the realization that sometimes you have to find it within yourself because it might not come from where you expect.
Yeah, it grounds the whole story. He wasn't just a wild and crazy guy. He was dealing with very real, relatable struggles.
And ultimately, the courage to pivot, to reinvent yourself when a chapter closes. That's a big one. How many of us hold on to things past their expiration date because it's comfortable or successful?
That's a challenging thought. Okay, let's try to boil this down. If we had to pick three final takeaways from Steve Martin's journey in Born Standing Up, what would they be? Let's start with an emotional insight.
Emotionally, I think it's the profound tension between the public persona and the private self, fueled by a deep need for connection and validation. Despite the massive fame, there's this undercurrent of loneliness and that complex relationship with his father, showing the human vulnerability behind the comedic mask.
That really resonates. Okay, what about an intellectual insight?
Intellectually, it has to be the power of mastery through relentless, deliberate practice combined with innovation via deconstruction. He didn't just get good, he got good by breaking down the rules, studying them intensely, and then rebuilding them in a completely original way. It was analytical and creative.
Learn, refine, innovate. Got it. And finally, a universal insight, something practical we can all apply.
Universally, I'd say it's the courage to recognize when a work is complete and to evolve beyond past successes, knowing when to kill your darlings, even the most successful ones, to maintain integrity and allow for continued personal and creative growth. That takes incredible self-awareness and bravery.
Wow, the dedication, the innovation, the courage.
Yeah.
It's an amazing story. Really makes you rethink what goes into creative success.
Absolutely. It's not magic. It's work. Intense, dedicated, sometimes lonely work. And knowing when the work is done.
A fantastic deep dive. Thanks for unpacking that with me.
My pleasure. It's a story with so many layers.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.